Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Providence Medford Grand Rounds for November. And this morning, our topic is street medicine, and we're happy to have with us Rachel Richmond and Helena Turner, who are both faculty at OHSU School of Nursing in Ashland. Rachel is a nurse educator, has worked extensively with the in-house population, and founded the street nursing team with a foot clinic in 2016, then a full street team starting in 2022. Helena is a psychiatric nurse practitioner who works in private practice at Paradigm Mental Health in Bedford, as well as on the street team to provide psychiatric services to the unhoused. Good morning.
Thank you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Want us to jump in?
You may jump in.
Hi, everybody. We want to thank Providence for welcoming us to Grand Rounds today, and we really look forward to presenting with you. I'm Rachel, and I'm the program manager for the field team for our street nursing. And so I'm going to start with an introduction to who we are and what the aims of our HRSA grant are with providing care for people experiencing homelessness. And then I'm joined by Helena Turner, who's our psychiatric nurse practitioner that's going to address the mental health and substance use disorder issues we see with our patients on the street. And then we will be introducing two of our senior nursing students in a few slides, and they're going to share some of the work they've been doing this term on educating community partners on and trying to do some myth busting around homelessness. So our objectives this morning are really to define who we are and then talk about some of the myths that are prevalent around people who are experiencing homelessness. And we're really going to specifically address some of the things that are seen in the healthcare setting. And then we're going to share with you our approach to care, which is a trauma and violence informed care approach. And we will also touch a little bit into harm reduction. And if that is of interest to anybody, we have an entire workshop on harm reduction. And then we're going to wrap up, hopefully, with discussion with everybody on how we could further collaborate with Providence on street nursing. So starting with who we are, we're a group of nurse educators, nurse practitioners, and students. Our care model is a reality-based holistic nursing care model, meaning that we meet our patients in their reality, out on the street, in a shelter, in an encampment, and we meet them there. And we really learn from our patients in terms of where they are in their journey through homelessness and how we can best come alongside them. So this approach to medical and nursing education is known as a street as classroom approach. And we're following a model that's practiced in many medical schools throughout the country and is new to nursing schools, where really if you show up on the street with humility and the ability to listen to the complex journeys people took into becoming unhoused, then the street will teach you. So our best teachers in this approach are the patients that we take care of on the street. And we've outlined here our goals for the grant. And I wanted to touch just briefly on our educational goal. So we're going to focus most of this presentation on our care of people experiencing homelessness. But a big arm of our grant is educating the future nursing workforce on how complex both homelessness and substance use disorder are. And we really feel like those complexities have not been included in medical and nursing education leading up to this point. And an understanding of those complexities really changes how we can work with patients that are in this condition. So the core services that we provide, so Dr. Webb mentioned that we started with a foot clinic. So starting in 2016, inspired by some physicians in Boston Healthcare for the Homeless that went to a nurse-led foot clinic and really said they were humbled by the approach of sitting with somebody soaking their feet and therapeutically listening to their story. We took that model and opened up a foot clinic that all of our students rotate through for at least a half a day. And then many of our street team students spend more extensive time at our foot clinics and also out on our street team. We provide wound care. We engage in harm reduction. Helena provides psychiatric care services on the street. We work as advocates in the hospital. We do a lot of care referral. And we've just recently relaunched a telehealth service from the street with our partners at La Clinica. And then we have created a set of trainings for best practices in working with people experiencing homelessness that we're bringing out to not only the healthcare setting, but to shelters and any other group where there's a high staff load that interacts with the unhoused community. We also work with students that really take an interest in street nursing for them to delve deeper during their leadership courses. So these are bullet points here are what our leadership students are working on right now. We have them go all the way to societal levels and look at how policy influences health. And that could be anywhere from within the clinic to citywide policies, state and national and international, and just seeing how different policies really strongly influence whether somebody can escape homelessness or not. We do continuous care model, which I'm going to let Helena speak to here in a little bit. And then we're really working on developing these trainings. So I wanted to just touch a little bit on chronic conditions. So when you look at chronic conditions in people experiencing homelessness, their health outcomes and mortality rates are probably they have the lowest life expectancy in our country. The average age of mortality for a rough sleeping person who's unsheltered is 47 years old. So this is a good three decades earlier than the general population. And it's really important our students, as they go out on the street, see this firsthand as we try to come alongside people with chronic conditions that are at a space where they really cannot navigate a complex healthcare system. And so we really try and come alongside them and help them navigate that. Speaking to that, I will let you know that since we've started our street team, we've had 7 of our patients die that we know from the street. And I think the oldest one was 60. So we definitely see this lower age of mortality. The other thing we really talk about, and this speaks to that, is housing as a social determinant of health. If they are remaining unsheltered, their life expectancy is just very low. The other thing that we see a lot in our patient population is trimorbidity. So a good proportion of our patients, this data shows 50%, I would maybe argue it's higher than that, present with 3 chronic conditions. And so they'll have a chronic physical condition, also a mental health diagnosis, and also be struggling with substance use disorder. And so this really adds to the complexities of caring for these patients. And as we've seen, it's really difficult when we have them interface with different clinics that are only looking at one piece of this complex picture. It's very difficult for these patients to stay compliant with the plan of care. And I already spoke to this a little bit, but this data here shows 50 years old as their age of mortality and compared to 77 years old with the general public. The number one cause of death in our patient population is overdose. And we have some bigger kind of population health presentations that we offer on the root causes of homelessness, but just pointing out the fact that we are in a housing crisis in this country and especially on the West Coast. So since the Silicon Valley and big tech boom on the West Coast, rates of homelessness have gone up over 1,000%. So we just have so many more people living unhoused as housing costs have skyrocketed on the West Coast. So that's our greater societal issue that we're seeing. And then that overlaps with our current opioid crisis. So we have more and more people living on the street. And then if you follow the waves of the opioid crisis, the first one being the wave of increased prescribing practices and a lot of people starting to use opioids that were prescribed so heavily in the 90s. This has just continued to carry out to the current wave we're in, which is the wave of synthetic opioids, which are very inexpensive and highly potent. And so those two bigger societal factors are really overlapping right now. And so we're seeing that just really up front and center with our work with the unhoused population. And I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce two of our senior leadership students that have been working with us this term. So Hannah and Danny are seniors in our School of Nursing. They're both in their leadership courses right now, and they both have a strong interest in working with this population, as well as when they enter into inpatient hospital care, really working as advocates for this population. So I'm going to turn it over to Hannah and Danny and let them talk about some myths that are pretty common that are surrounding people experiencing homelessness.
Hi, everybody. I'm Hannah Whitescorn. And like Rachel said, some of our project this term has just been trying to bust some of the common myths that we've found in the community about this population. After we go through these, we can talk for a few minutes about our experience being on the street team as students, but here we go. You can click for us. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Danielle. And the first myth is homelessness is a choice. But in reality, it's often the result of systemic issues such as poverty, lack of affordable housing, and inadequate social services. Also, some people do not have a choice. So, for example, in the US, one out of every five youth in foster care will experience homelessness in their first 4 years of aging out of the system. The large majority of people experiencing homelessness would move inside if safe and affordable housing were available, but many people in this population, they really lack an alternative option that feels safe and stable.
Myth number two is that people don't want to use the resources that are available, but in reality, Oregon actually ranks last, so 50th nationally, in our access to mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And we rank very high in our prevalence of substance use disorder and mental health. And there's also a very large shelter shortage, especially in our local counties and in our state. So as of 2022 in Oregon, there's an estimated 18,000 people experiencing homelessness, and we only have around 5,200 shelter beds available. Also, as of January of last year, it was reported that in Jackson County alone, we have an average number of zero empty shelter beds, and we have an average of 600 people sleeping on the streets every night. I think this gives a really good perspective of the number of people, even just where we live, that are experiencing this situation.
Myth number three, all homeless people are mentally ill and have substance use disorder. But in reality, while a considerable number of people in this population have a severe mental illness or substance use disorder, most estimates indicate that less than 50% of the nation's people experiencing homelessness are affected by these conditions. So in 2022, 21% reported having a severe mental illness and only 16% reported a chronic substance abuse.
Myth number four is the myth that homeless people don't want to work or that they don't want to pay for housing because it's expensive, or the myth that homeless people are lazy. But in reality, we do know that most are actively trying to find work or are currently working, but experiencing barriers to employment is very common. So we included some common barriers here, such as having a criminal background, employers having a stigma, a lack of access to the interview requirements that you will need, such as transportation, internet, identification, an address, or even a shower and clean clothing. And studies consistently show that a lack of affordable housing is the best predictor of homelessness.
Myth number five, homeless people are dangerous criminals. But in reality, they're no more likely to be criminals than housed individuals. So, it's not like a homeless thing. In fact, they face a disproportionate rate of violence, violent victimization compared to the general population. So as many as 49% of individuals who are experiencing homelessness are estimated to be victims of violence. And that's compared to 2% of the national population.
Myth number six is that homelessness is an issue only in urban areas. But in reality, we know that this is actually a nationwide issue, and it does affect both urban and rural areas. It's important to note that rural areas, like the homelessness in rural areas, might be underestimated and it might have a lack of visibility. So in the cities, it might be more prevalent and more seen, but in a lot of these rural communities, it is still very prevalent. So for example, in the rural communities of Oregon, we have even more limited behavioral health providers and treatment options, and even longer wait lists than Oregonians experiencing homelessness in the Portland, Salem, and Eugene corridors.
Number seven, homeless people don't want help. But in reality, many people actually do want help, and they face significant barriers to accessing services. So when we're talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, when we're not getting water, food, shelter, sleep, and clothing, it's really, really hard to focus on anything else because you're in survival mode the whole time.
Myth number eight is that homelessness is a result of mental illness and substance use disorder. But in reality, we've found that experiencing homelessness is actually recognized as a risk factor for precipitating both mental illness symptoms and substance use disorder, or exacerbating these symptoms. And the trauma of experiencing homelessness can actually expose individuals to the stressors that will increase their vulnerability to experience these conditions. So it's important to note that while they may be intertwined, that these can actually be a risk that can be caused by experiencing homelessness.
Number nine, most homeless people are single men, but in reality, families with children make up a significant portion of the homeless population. So Oregon saw a 27% increase in the number of families experiencing homelessness between 2020 and 2022. And it was also reported that 59% of homeless individuals who are in families with children were living unsheltered in 2022. So no other state has nearly as high as a percentage of people in homeless families living unsheltered. And we don't want to be number one in that category.
And lastly, myth number 10 is that homelessness is a temporary problem that can be easily solved. But as we can see with this evidence, this is a complex issue and its prevalence will continue to increase until long-term solutions can be implemented, such as affordable housing and comprehensive social services. So just a good fact to show for the prevalence here in Oregon, as we've been stating, we experienced one of the nation's largest increase in homelessness between 2020 and 2022. And our number grew by nearly 23%. As I said earlier, we have around 18,000 people experiencing homelessness in Oregon as of last year. And this is compared to a national average increase of only 1%. So those are our myths, and we created a handout that we've been putting around the community with a lot of these to try to spread this information out into the community a little bit more. And we've really enjoyed doing a lot of this work. Me and Danny have been presenting and educating around the community at different places that work with this population, and it's been really enjoyable. And just being on the street team for me has really helped me have a completely different perspective of the way I want to go into being a nurse. And personally, I had never realized that this was an option of nursing, and my heart is so much more open to working out in the community as a nurse when I graduate. So I just want to say that I think this program has helped me individually so well, but I think it's such a big step for our community, and I'm just very blessed to be a part of it.
Thanks, Hannah. And my experience is that I was homeless for about 2.5 years. And a little backstory on how I became homeless was I was abused as a child. So I have a lot of ACEs, and I became a mother at 15. I graduated high school a year early. And after high school, I got into a very bad relationship and was married to someone who was physically and emotionally abusive. And trying to get away from that person, I became homeless, and I was had to leave my son with my parents, and I was out on the streets, a rough sleeper, which meant that I had nowhere to go. I didn't have a car, and I didn't know how to get help. And there were a lot of times where, you know, I'd walk into a hospital and people would be rude to me. And so I just felt like there was no help for me and there was no hope. And I eventually got into drugs, and I was diagnosed with PTSD last year. And I really wish that I had a street team that was on my side, because I know that the work that's being done here is incredibly important, and the trauma and violence-informed care that's being taught to us as students and around the community is also important, because we're learning how to effectively communicate with this population. And I remember walking into one hospital, and the nurse was incredibly kind to me, and she spent extra time with me, and she let me call my mom. And that was the turning point in my life where I decided I wanted to be a nurse, and I was able to get the help that I needed. And it's just really amazing that I'm here and I'm in this position with the street team where I feel like I can give back to the community that I was a part of. And yeah, that's it. I'm insanely happy to be a part of this.
Thank you so much for your presentation, Hannah and Danny, and for sharing your perspective on the street team. So we, you know, when it, as Danny alluded to, so much of what we do is really practicing trauma and violence-informed care. We recognize that many of the people who are experiencing homelessness are trauma survivors, and they are also currently experiencing trauma just from living on the street. I see that a lot in all of the people that I'm trying to help through my psychiatric services. It's a given that trauma is a part of their story, which only, you know, intensifies what they're going through when they also have mental illnesses or substance use disorders, and all of those three things feed into each other. We in, you know, when we go into our approach. So, you know, when we, in understanding that, so many of the people who are living on the street have experienced trauma and violence throughout their lives, you know, we approach them with humility. We approach them, actually, we allow them to approach us. We're out there in the community and we wait for people to come to us and we let them know that we're a safe place. It's just the street team. We know that there's also the livability team who go out and are also trying to engage with this population. But the livability team goes out, it's members of the police as well as other members of the community. We have not engaged with that group, with the livability team, with the understanding that a lot of our people that we work with are frightened of the police. And so we have kind of separated ourselves from that to give them a safe place and a safe space and know that we're approachable and that, you know, they're not going to get ticketed or any of those sorts of things when they come and talk to us. If you see us out on the street, when we're talking to people, we're just sitting on the street with them. We're not standing over them. We're not, you know, approaching them in a very forceful way. We just, you know, we're out milling around. A lot of times you can't even tell that we're anybody different. And in fact, we've been approached by the police and told to move along. So they think that we are also living on the street. So, you know, we really do try to blend in and be, you know, not a forceful presence on the street. We encourage all of our students to also, you know, behave in those same ways and to just allow people to come to us and share space with us. A lot of the time we find that with our patients, it takes a long time for them to trust us enough. So we're really just trying to build trust out in the community. They are now starting to trust us. They know about us. The word is spreading and we are starting to be recognized. But we will oftentimes work with someone or meet someone like 20, 30, 40, 50 times before they will say, okay, actually, can you give me some help? And we have somebody who very, very recently, we have been working, known him for, is it like a year and a half or so? And we've known that he has lots of things that he needs help with, including substance use disorders and mental health and also physical health issues. And he has not felt safe enough to come to us. And just very, very, like last week, he came and said, okay, I'd like some help. And it took that long of us just being out there every single week and seeing him every week and for him to feel like he could approach us and ask us for help. We recognize that the service system, so the, you know, any healthcare facility and all of the other services that are available can actually re-traumatize individuals when they are coming for help. And if they are addressed with any, you know, they're highly sensitive to any perceived judgment, any stigma. And so, you know, we are trying to heal some of that for people and to help them to see, like, we're nurses and we want you to engage in the healthcare system. We try to bridge those gaps. So we're bringing people back in to services and helping them to access all of the services that are out there. That is the primary focus of what we do. And it's the primary focus of what we do with our nursing students is helping them to understand how people who have experienced trauma are very hypervigilant and frightened and are expecting or going into a situation expecting to be stigmatized and expecting to experience further trauma and further violence. And we're trying to show them there is another way. So this was somewhat alluded to, but, you know, there is an almost directly proportional risk of experiencing homelessness as an adult as the number of ACEs increases. I'm sure everybody knows about ACEs, but they are, you know, those traumatic events that occur before a child is 18. There's a much higher risk of developing a mental illness and or substance use disorder later in life for people who experience ACEs. And then as we all know, you know, that also comes along with a lot of adverse physical outcomes, including cancer, diabetes, obesity, all of those sorts of things. And I hear it every single day being out on the street. These people are, used to experiencing these traumas, and it's had a direct influence on their health. So this is a really wonderful slide. I love this one that just shows that ACEs are, both in those childhood experiences, but also the community environments. This really speaks to the trauma and violence informed care, understanding that our systems and our communities are actually re-traumatizing people. Poverty, discrimination, community disruption, lack of opportunity, violence, poor housing quality and affordability, all of these things are also contributing to the adverse outcomes for people in terms of their health and their mental health. And there is another way of approaching this, and that we need to be working on, creating better community environments for people. So the four principles of trauma and violence informed care are understanding and awareness of trauma and violence and how it impacts people's lives. Creating emotionally, culturally, and physically safe environments for people who access services and the providers. Fostering opportunities for choice, collaboration, and connection, and providing strengths-based and capacity-building ways to support people who access services. We talk about this a lot with our students. When people who have experienced trauma and violence in their lives, we know that we always talk about it as fight or flight. People are either going to get ready to fight somebody, or they're going to, run away. There's also, though, I call it going possum, like just that shutdown of just nothing. And so a lot of people who experience trauma throughout their life, especially people who've experienced childhood trauma, they will maybe present just with a flat affect. They're emotionally numbed and they're very passive. They're withdrawn. They might not ever seek out any services. They're just absolutely shut down. So that's another, it's not just fight or flight, that's that hyper arousal, but there's also the hypo arousal of that kind of a response to trauma as well. And what we're trying to do is to get people into their window of tolerance when we're working with someone who has a history of trauma, but getting them comfortable. So making them feel safe when we approach people, having your shoulders back and like being open, smiling, being highly aware of anything that could trigger someone's thought that they might be in danger, giving them space, not crowding them, and letting them know that you're open to whatever it is that they want to share with you. And so, helping them to get into that window of tolerance so that then they can be open to accepting services and listening to what you're trying to say. When someone has trauma, they have a really hard time. Their frontal lobe is offline, and they're just in their limbic system, and they're just like looking for danger. They're not going to be able to listen to, offers of help, to instructions. We need to get them into that window of tolerance so that they can be open to that.
I wanted to add a comment on that. One area that we see this a lot and have discussions about with our students is when our patients present to the emergency department. So if they've had a previous negative experience, or even if they haven't, going into that structured environment often pushes them out of their window of tolerance. And so we have a really good example of a patient we knew that had just incredible traumas in his life, but had previously worked in the medical system before those traumas. But whenever he would enter into the hospital, he would go on this hyperarousal mode and either walk out on his own or be kicked out because he just couldn't keep it together. And so over building a relationship with us, he started saying, "Can you help me get to the doctor so that I don't lose my temper?" Because we just would engage with him out on the street over and over. So we started accompanying him to primary care. And we've been working with this individual for about a year and a half. And he generally doesn't go to the emergency department anymore. That used to be his only source of care. And in really kind of building trust with our team, then having us join him and introducing him as a kind of warm handoff to primary care, we've been able to really help him manage his conditions in other ways. And he is currently housed right now.
For people who are experiencing homelessness, stigma is disproportionately affecting their health outcomes and their mental well-being. When people experience stigma, kind of as Danny was talking about, really, you know, when they experience stigma, they're going to not want to access the help that's out there. And they walk in the door and they experience stigma and they're back out the door again. It's just too traumatic for them, and they will just stop even trying to access that care. So we are trying to create a welcoming space, and we're hoping that through these kind of talks that other facilities, that other healthcare providers kind of think about those things when they encounter someone who is coming to them from the street, understanding that it is taking a lot for that person to even walk in that door. They're scared. We have a hard time convincing people. It's funny how everybody's like, you know, these people who are experiencing homelessness, they're just using the hospitals for this, that, and the rest, you know, all these things. And we actually have a very difficult time convincing people to go to the hospital or to go to a health clinic because they have experienced so much stigma. And they tell us that they just can't do it. But, you know, just the dehumanization that they experience can be really, really traumatic for them. And they experience that in the prison system too, you know, because a lot of times they're going to prison for, you know, being homeless, frankly. And so they experience it there and they experience it in the healthcare arena. And so we're hoping that people can come to this population with a different and new understanding of all the trauma that they have experienced and how difficult it is for them to even walk through that door. So this is kind of what, you know, what I was just speaking to. People who are homeless, a lot of them do have substance use disorders, and a lot of them are turning to substances as a coping mechanism. They're out on the street. I mean, imagine, you know, you're terrified, you have a history of trauma, you have nowhere to sleep, and here in Medford and in this area, you're not even allowed to have a tent anymore or even a piece of cardboard to sleep on. That's considered sleeping paraphernalia, and they're not allowed to have that. So, you know, they cannot have any shelter, they can't have anything warm, they can't have a sleeping bag or anything of that nature. And, you know, they're freezing or they're getting rained on or they're burning hot and there's smoke or whatever it is, you know. They will be turning to substances. So it's not just opioids, you know, it's also meth. And there's been a huge rise in meth overdoses. I think it's like 34 or 38,000 deaths from meth in the nation last year. So that's a rising risk also. People will use these two substances either to take away the pain and the fear, or also to keep themselves awake, so that they're not becoming victims of further violence, as was spoken to earlier, that, you know, at least 50% of people who are experiencing homelessness are experiencing violence. So they use meth to keep themselves awake at night. They're terrified. And then they are then stigmatized for using the only kind of coping that is available to them, unfortunately. They then get stigmatized. And we definitely know that healthcare providers treat patients with substance use disorders differently than they do other patients. So this is obviously what we're trying to do, train future healthcare providers to deliver, you know, compassionate care without prejudice and stigma to people experiencing homelessness. When we can do those things, then we're going to improve their health outcomes overall. Several studies indicate that programs focused on educating medical students, and I would say nursing students, about substance use disorders and exposing them to people with substance use disorders are likely to decrease their stigmatizing attitudes and increase their comfort levels towards working with this population. And we see this with our students all the time. People who have substance use disorders are people. And they are people who are in pain, and they're people who need care, and they are people who need compassion more than anybody else. And they're scared. So this is a huge focus of our program.
And they also are no longer making a choice. So that's another thing we really, you know, talk about over and over is when they have substance use disorder, their brain, they have a chronic condition at this point.
Yeah, brain gets hijacked. Yeah, once they're there, then they no longer have that choice. And it becomes a thing like on that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's basically their bottom thing is they're seeking that substance because their brain has been hijacked. They can't really think of anything else or start to attend to any of those other things until they get that substance or get into treatment. Unfortunately, in this area, the people that I'm working with who have that substance use disorder and also something like schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder or bipolar, there is nowhere, it is so difficult to get them stabilized because we don't have, there's one in the works, but we don't have a dual diagnosis program. People have to go to Eugene or Corvallis or Portland or anywhere, you know, and there's really nowhere for them to go. So it becomes a very difficult situation. So for those who do have a substance use disorder, you know, we are very supportive of implementing harm reduction strategies to reduce the adverse health effects that we know come along with those substance use disorders. It is evidence-based. We know that it works, and it is responsible for decreased rates of infection, overdose, chronic disease, and death in this population. It's essential that we implement harm reduction strategies because there aren't enough treatment facilities available. Contrary to popular opinion, people who have substance use disorders who are on the street, they want to get treatment. They cannot access treatment. There is not enough treatment available out in the community, especially for this population. They're not housed and they cannot, you know, be sober when they're on the street, you know, living in these kind of conditions. They have nowhere else to go. So they really need residential facilities to go and become sober. Harm reduction challenges that myth that drug use is a moral failing, understands that substance use disorders are chronic illnesses that can affect anyone. We see this all the time. You know, there are lots of harm reduction examples that are out there in the world, like free cab rides on holidays and the Super Bowl, nicotine patches, safer sex education, seat belts, speed limits. All of these things are reducing harms. We know that people are engaging in risky behaviors and we're trying to reduce those harms and trying to keep our population safe, trying to keep our neighbors safe. These harm reduction strategies that are implemented out in the world for substance use disorders, like, you know, syringe exchange and all the different things that we do, right? Handing out bubbles and, you know, all of these sorts of things are really just a continuation of these other harm reduction principles that we employ all the time out in the world. We are partnered with Max's Mission, as well as other harm reduction groups like Melissa Stab and Wagon. And these groups are doing things like Narcan distribution and training, overdose prevention training, medication-assisted treatment. I will prescribe for, I cannot prescribe methadone. People have to go to the methadone clinic for that, but I can prescribe buprenorphine. Peer advocacy and support programs, PrEP to prevent HIV transmission, fentanyl test strips, the Never Use Alone hotline, which is fantastic. You know, all of these things are harm reduction examples. Our students also do Narcan training for out in the community for anybody who doesn't know how to administer Narcan. And, you know, this is something that we are working hard to address is the, you know, healthcare workers who are using terms like drug seeking and non-compliant, frequent flyer. It's hopeless. They did this to themselves. You give them an inch and they take a mile, you know, hot in a cot, like whatever, you know, all of these sorts of things. We're really trying to, you know, challenge that way of thinking about people who are experiencing homelessness.
I'll also comment to that. We did a workshop with our faculty And, you know, we, our nursing faculty just has so much collective experience, but many of them really aren't in this realm. And so some of these terms we'll teach about when we're teaching about street nursing, how harmful those terms are. And the students were saying, but we're hearing our faculty using these terms. And the, especially the term frequent flyer, that is such a common term that you hear very frequently. The other is drug seeking. And so we did a workshop with our faculty, and we're trying to bring that out to any group that wants it in terms of how those terms are so stigmatizing and really just not accurate, especially with fentanyl in the drug supply right now. Any pain medication that a patient receives when they're in the hospital is not nearly what they are getting on the street. And so if somebody is in pain, they still have that human right to pain control. And I also am a hospital-based nurse on call, and I do hear these types of, this is just common language in the hospitals. Our students hear it all the time. And this is one of the big things that we're trying to bring awareness to, is this oversimplification of why somebody is cycling frequently through the hospitals, or if they're continuing to use substances, how can we see that as they are not getting what they need versus putting the blame on that individual for this very complex situation they're involved in?
And I mean, the thing is that this is, you know, the only place that they can come for care, generally speaking. A lot of people are also a lot of the people that I work with, they will have had a provider in the past, but because of being unhoused, they have a difficult time getting to their appointments. I mean, they lose track of time. They have their phone stolen. They, you know, they don't, there are various reasons why they may not make it to appointments, and then they get kicked off, and they're told that they cannot any longer be a patient at that place. And so, you know, sometimes the hospitals are literally the only place that they can go for any kind of care whatsoever. So, you know, that's coming into a lot of this with the frequent flyer sort of label. Where else are they supposed to go and get any help?
There's also an interesting thing that happens on the street in terms of, like Helen was alluding to, what day is it? What time is it? If really people are at that bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, it's difficult for them to track appointments and keep appointments and get the transportation across town to make it to the appointment. So we see that a lot.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of them can't, they don't, like, they're in wheelchairs, they're in, you know, and they cannot, they don't even have bus passes, so they can't get to their appointments. So do words matter? Yes, of course they do. Right. I mean, when we use language that stigmatizes these people who are experiencing homelessness, then it negatively affects the way everybody in the society views them. Language frames what the public thinks about this population and affects how they think about themselves. Then they become self-stigmatizing and they don't feel like they deserve the care. And again, it leads into them not seeking the care, and it leads into us having to convince them to go and ask for help. We recently have a new shelter that opened up near my neighborhood. And it's just a temporary shelter, and that there was a community hearing about it. For any of the neighboring people who were going to be near this shelter. And there were a lot of people there who were very definitely compassionate towards this community. But there was, but even those people who were compassionate towards this community were scared. They were frightened and scared. And they thought that because this shelter was going to be open, that the people who were going to be in the shelter were going to be violent towards them, were going to be, you know, all sorts of things. They were terrified for their children. They were terrified for the schools. They were terrified for themselves, you know. And so this is where this comes in, right? So now the shelter is having a lot of trouble, or was having a lot of trouble. And in fact, it's not probably going to be funded moving forward as of right now. And, you know, this kind of stigmatizing language comes into that. And now the people who need shelter and their families in that shelter, and that shelter is going to be closing in the beginning of January in winter. And so, you know, now that shelter is not going to be accessible to people because of this kind of stigmatizing language and the impacts that it has on the community. Nonverbal communication, as I kind of spoke to earlier, like good position and posture, making yourself look accessible and look non-threatening is really, really important. Giving people space, you know, and that congruence between verbal and nonverbal. So, you know, you can be saying one thing and looking another way, and that's very off-putting to people. So making sure that, like, both what you're saying and how you're approaching people looks open and non-threatening is really important.
Our foot soak clinics give the students an excellent opportunity to, for this nonverbal, to sit with someone. And we've had many students very, because of a lot of these societal messages around people who are unhoused, they're very hesitant to sit down. And once they sit down with someone and have a conversation and realize it's two humans talking, you know, a lot of the things I had, attributes I had assigned to this person are not, we talk about homelessness as a state and not a trait. And so you can't take a large population and lump a trait to them.
We just had a question as to which shelter is closing.
So this is up in Ashland. So there's Ora, the city of Ashland. Ora is, it has temporary care of a shelter that the city of Ashland opened near Shop and Cart. There's a new shelter there. But it's just a temporary shelter for like from here until I think it's January 2nd or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's there's no further funding for it after that. So, yeah.
I saw the time, so I see after this.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So if you're interested, you know, thank you for coming. If you're interested in learning more, we have those workshops that Rachel alluded to earlier. There are also some online classes that are not ours, but there are some online classes that you can engage in. And then, you know, finally, just, you know, getting involved in the local community.
And we are having Linda share a digital packet with our flyer and how you can work with us. One thing to consider is very difficult for people to get into primary care. I'm sure a lot of people here know that it's difficult. When we try to get people into the federally qualified health centers, La Clinica and Rogue Community Health, it takes about 6 to 9 months. And so during that interim, we can work with them between the La Clinica Mobile Health Unit and our street team to bridge that gap if there's somebody that comes into the hospital with complex care needs, that you can alert us and we'll try to bridge that gap. You can also call us. Helena has had a really good relationship going with the Behavioral Health Unit at Asante, where they will, if somebody's going to be discharged to the street, they will call her and she can ideally see them in the hospital before they're discharged, or they can line up her meeting them on the street.
I've been able to go every time, actually.
Oh,
so yeah, and just and then do a warm handoff so I meet the person while they're on the unit, and then we make a plan for a follow-up care.
And then the last thing is, and this may already be standard practice, but if people come in with recurrent skin and wound issues related to drug use, make sure that part of the discharge is that they have access to naloxone and clean supplies. So this, the bottom line there is they are 3 to 5 times more likely to find recovery with access to harm reduction.
Well, thank you for really great presentation, these folks in our community. So if, I guess the question I would have, if I have a patient who is homeless and, you know, I'd like to see them, or I think of the ones I've had, they show up occasionally and then you'll go a long time without seeing them. Mm-hmm. We could contact you all and maybe coordinate some care somehow.
Absolutely.
A way to communicate. How would we communicate that?
Is our phone number?
Yeah. So the flyer that Linda's distributing has our street nursing line. And if that, especially that kind of patient, let us know. And also when you see them, ask them where they sleep, you know, mm-hmm. Get a rough idea of where they're staying. Give them our number. They can call us too. Some clinics will call us with them. A lot of times they don't have a phone.
Right.
So, but that's why I say if you can get an idea where they sleep, or when they're with, if you're there with them, call us with the patient right there and we will make a plan to come visit them on the street. And then we can see them regularly until they have their next visit with you.
I see 9 people weekly. Like, of all the people that I'm working with, I see them weekly. So, yeah, so we just provide that really like hands-on care.
So there's a reasonable chance we already know them.
Yes.
Or have interacted with them.
Possibly. You know, there are, unfortunately, there are so many unhoused out there. And we know the ones who approach us. Again, we don't go out and push ourselves upon people. And so it, you know, there are a lot of people who are hiding out. And that, and we may not know them, you know, but you know, we know a fair amount of the population, or we might know somebody who knows them. You know, a lot of times like that's how we find people. We'll just walk around out there and say, hey, do you know where Mary Sue is? You know, and they will know them, and we find people that way because we're trusted enough in the community now that people will tell us, you know, oh yeah, we saw her under the bridge, you know, down by blah blah blah. So yeah.
For those of you who are attending virtually, I will make sure that their flyer and their digital documents packets go into this meeting chat after we conclude the meeting today.
And for discharge planners, case managers, anybody like that, we're happy to have a smaller in-person meeting with you to get to know you and, you know, come up with a plan that works with you and how you interact with patients.
Excellent.
You mentioned the dual diagnosis, I think it was the inpatient treatment. Would that be like substance abuse plus mental illness?
Yeah, sorry. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Yeah. So those people who are experiencing those two things together, they just, you know, it becomes a really difficult, tricky thing to try to treat both of those things.
And we have something coming for this area.
Yeah. That's just 7 beds. Yeah. It's something, but it's definitely not enough because of every single one of the people that I work with.
Well, maybe you're still the unit.
Yes, easily. So, you know, and the problem is that a lot of times, like sometimes some of the people that I work with, they might have a family member who can take them in for a period of time, but those two things working together means that the family member becomes an unsafe situation or becomes untenable. And the ACT team, they can't work with them for various reasons. And, you know, there's just nowhere for them to go. Unfortunately, our mental health system is completely broken. And, you know, the Beckett Center can't take them because they're not stable. The, you know, the state hospital system won't take them because they're not threatening to, you know, harm themselves or others. And, you know, there's just nothing for them. And so we need more of those dual diagnosis meds, but there aren't any.
Oh, you know, one thing we forgot to mention is we do have some OHSU foundation funds that we've been using for respite care. The OHP Flex funding is just a very lengthy process. And a lot of times we have somebody that is ill. They're not quite sick enough to be in the hospital, but they're definitely too sick to be on the street. So we've been using those foundation funds to put them in motel rooms for a few nights. And then we're also renting one shelter bed for people with more chronic conditions. And we just had a really good success speaking to the dual diagnosis of Helena visiting the people we put in that shelter bed. And they just moved into their first apartment. They've been on the street for a decade.
He's working full time now and he's stable on his meds and both of them are stable on their meds. I mean, it's been really wonderful.
Could you tell us about how you're working to get your notes into Epic through LaClinica's?
So that is like literally in the process right now. So I think if people wanted to enter a note now, if you can get it to La Clinica, the mobile health team can access it.
Okay.
And they are, I mean, we have a meeting today that we will, the street team, since we're now doing telehealth with the mobile health team, we're having much more of a deep partnership where they'll tell us, hey, Providence, put this note in, can you go see this patient?
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll be able to communicate that way.
Wonderful. Because that was a barrier for a while.
That was a barrier for sure. It's been a process.
So you all will make chart notes in Epic.
Yes.
That then we would be able to see.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. That's been our big victory in the last couple of months.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the work that you're doing, and you don't see any other questions.
The morning reflection. 8 o'clock. Can we have?